Warning. This episode contains depictions of high-level drug use, extreme violence, and unbridled terror that may be distressing to some listeners. Under no circumstances should the following podcast be consumed by children, the elderly, or the squeamish.
There's an old, decrepit theater down the end of a dark, deserted alley. On the 13th night of every month, Baron Sordor throws open his theater doors to the lucky few invited to see the show. The crowd are slowly ushered inside and take their seats, whispering in nervous expectation. Then the music starts to rise, and the red velvet curtains are drawn aside. A dark figure strides to the edge of the stage, and the audience gasps in hushed anticipation. Because when the clock strikes midnight, it's time for Baron Sordor's Theater of the Doomed.
Thank you, dear Ralphus, and good evening, honored guests. I am your host, Baron Vladimir Sordor. Welcome to another night at the Theater of the Doomed. I hope that you are prepared for what awaits you, and I would encourage the more craven and weak-willed members of our audience to take the chance to leave now, for tonight's show is not for the faint of heart. Together, we will be delving into the deepest, darkest depths of delusion and delirium, pushing aside the philosophical and psychological boundaries of the human condition, and peering into the boundless void of the existential abyss. Be brave, dear audience, for where we dare to tread is a place very few come back unchanged. I present to you the Infernal Circle of Eternal Return.
This life, as you now live it and have lived it, you will have to live it once more and innumerable times more. And there'll be nothing new in it but every pain and every joy and every thought and sigh. The eternal hourglass of existence is turned over again and again, and you with it, speck of dust. Friedrich Nietzsche, 1882.
Brady Hitchcock is a broken man. He was once an upstanding member of society, a pillar of the community, if you will. Brady was a police sergeant and a respected family man, with a loving wife and a beautiful daughter. He coached his kids' soccer team on the weekend and once a month volunteered at a soup kitchen to help out the city's homeless. But all of that came to a crashing halt the first week of September last year. You see, Brady, like a lot of so-called family men approaching midlife, wasn't all he appeared to be. He'd started drinking after his daughter was born. Now, Brady had always been a drinker. Most cops are. But before his daughter, Ellie, was born, it was normally just a beer with lunch or maybe a whiskey or two after a hard day. But things changed. 2 years after becoming a dad, he was fall down drunk at a bar most every night after work, shaking down hookers for drugs and a blowjob, or fucking any woman he could find in the back seat of his car before slinking home to his wife and kid. That is, if he went home at all. He told himself he behaved the way he did because his wife didn't pay attention to him like she used to, now that the baby was here. He pitied himself, and complained that he didn't feel like part of the family anymore. He even tried to convince himself that his indiscretions were his wife's fault and not his. But deep down, he knew the truth. Even if he didn't want to admit it. His wife knew too. She'd always known he was the kind of guy that stuck his dick into anything with a pulse. But at least before Ellie was born, he'd had the decency to be discreet about it. And as much as she hated him for it, she ignored his philandering because he was a good provider and a good father for Ellie. But nothing lasts forever. And after 11 years of humiliation, Brady's wife, Heidi, had had enough. So she left him. Brady came home after working a double shift to find the locks on his house changed and all of his clothes packed up into two suitcases that were sitting neatly on the front porch. A note pinned to the top told him she never wanted to see him ever again, and if he came near the house, she'd file a restraining order against him. This sent Brady over the edge. Broken-hearted, spiteful, and filled with rage and self-loathing, he started drinking all day, every day, leveling himself out with coke and smack and quaaludes. His work suffered, as did every friendship he had. He blamed everyone but himself for his problems, and instead of looking inward, he lashed out at everyone around until he found himself here, right now, living in a shithole apartment and sleeping off another bender with some random barmaid passed out beside him. Friday the 4th of June 1976. Port Patay, Holy Cross Parish, 7:10 a.m. Brady Hitchcock's apartment. Brady Hitchcock opens his bloodshot eyes and peers blearily at the blaring alarm clock on his bedside table.
Jesus fucking Christ. What time is it?
He reaches over and slams his hand down hard on the top of the alarm. Brady lies in bed, letting the sickly waves of his hangover wash over him. He considers closing his eyes and going back to sleep, then remembers he has to go to work today. Slowly, he sits up, swings his legs over the side of the bed, ignoring the ruin of his head screaming in protest. His bedroom is a disaster. The bedside table and the floor are littered with empty beer cans, dirty clothes, and a quarter-filled bottle of whiskey. The remnants of an 8-ball of cocaine are spilled across the top of his dresser. He tries to stand up and feels his stomach lurch. Brady reaches down and grabs the bottle of whiskey, twisting off the lid and chugging. It's not till he's almost finished the bottle that he notices the woman in the bed beside him.
Hey. Hello. You awake?
Brady stands up, shakes her roughly. Sheila Crawford, the woman in his bed that he seduced last night at the Gemini Lounge, rolls over and looks at him, smiling with warm, dusty eyes.
Good morning.
Yeah. Hi.
Sheila ignores his rude tone and stretches seductively across the bed, letting the bedsheet slip down across her naked body.
Oh, it's so early. Why don't you come back to bed?
I'm sorry,
Sheila Crawford's face crumples and she sits up, pulling the sheets over her naked chest.
It's Sheila. I can't believe you don't remember my name.
Look, you gotta get out of here. I gotta go to work.
Yeah, all right. Just give me a minute. Am I gonna see you tonight? I don't start till 9. I thought we could get some dinner if you're not busy.
Look, I don't want to be rude or nothing. How about I just see you at the bar sometime?
You fucking prick.
Hey, calm down. There's no reason to get angry.
Fuck you, you fucking piece of shit.
Tears of humiliation and anger run down Sheila's face. She lashes out at Brady. scratching his arm.
Jesus, get your shit and get out of here before I kick your fucking ass.
Sheila scrambles out of bed, grabbing her clothes from the floor and dressing quickly.
You're a fucking asshole. You know that? You can't treat people like this.
Yeah. Tell your story, Walken.
Half-dressed, Sheila runs to the bedroom door. She stops and looks back at him.
I thought you were special. I thought we...
Brady snarls and throws the empty whiskey bottle at her.
Get the fuck out of here.
The bottle shatters on the wall near Sheila's head and she runs out of the room.
Don't you ever fucking speak to me again. You got that?
The front door slams closed and Brady is left standing there by himself. Then the phone rings.
Hello?
Brady, is that you?
Yeah, Captain.
Jesus, you sound like shit.
No, I'm alright. I think I got a cold or something.
Yeah, all right, Brady. If you say so. We got a call about 20 minutes ago. Another girl went missing last night. Looks like our killer's back again.
Shit. What do we know?
Not much. All Metro officers have been called in to help. Your partner's on his way to pick you up now.
Right now? I mean, Captain, I'm...
Just pull yourself together. You got 15 minutes.
The phone goes dead before Brady can say another thing. 15 minutes isn't long. Brady showers quickly, then dresses in the cleanest outfit he can find on the floor. When he's presentable, he cuts himself two long lines of coke on the dresser and washes them down with a beer before he heads out the door. ...7:32 a.m. Detective Lee Lucas's sedan. Brady Hitchcock pushes open the dented double doors of his apartment building and walks outside, just as his partner's shitty brown Ford is pulling up to the curb. It's bitterly cold out, and Brady pops the collar of his brown leather coat against the wind as he crosses the street and gets into the car.
Morning, Sergeant.
Brady regards his partner with contempt, choosing to ignore his pleasantries, and lights a cigarette instead. The car fills with acrid blue smoke, and Lee Lucas coughs uncomfortably.
You mind opening your window, Sarge?
Brady shakes his head with disdain and rolls down the window a crack. He'd never liked Lee Lucas, not since he was partnered up with him a year ago. Brady thought he was a douchebag, a fucking show-off with perfectly blow-waved hair. He wore fucking sneakers and flared jeans, for Christ's sake. What kind of cop wore sneakers on the job? And that fucking brown-nosing at-risk youth outreach program he ran to impress the brass made him want to puke. No one was buying it, least of all Brady. He sneers to himself and retrieves his silver hip flask from inside his jacket pocket and takes a long drink. His partner frowns disapprovingly, but remains tight-lipped. His eyes on the road.
You got a problem?
No problem, Sergeant.
Yeah, you do. I can't stand this fucking passive-aggressive shit, you hear me, Detective? I've got a fucking lifetime of it already coming from my ex-wife.
Well, I mean, it's not even 8 o'clock in the morning.
What do you fucking care?
I just think we got a job to do, is all. Another girl's gone missing. It's probably not going to help too much if you're drinking on the job.
Is that so?
I mean, I don't think the captain would be too happy if he knew you were coming to work drunk.
Really? And who's going to tell him? You?
No.
Yeah. Just in case you forgot, Detective, I've been an officer here in Port Patay since 54. That's 22 years on the force, shitbag. I've been a fucking sergeant here in Metro for the past 9. Now, when did you transfer in? What, a year ago?
18 months, sir.
Fucking know-it-all, rookie. Get this through your head, okay? I'm the big fucking fish in this pond, and you're just a fucking turd floating in the bowl. You even think about going to the captain, and I'll personally see that you're busted down to uniform and doing paperwork till you're blind. You got that?
Yeah, I got it.
Good. Then shut the fuck up and drive the car.
And now, a message from our sponsors.
They thought he was dead, but they were wrong. And now, from the depths of his wretched tomb... He rises. Run, but you cannot escape. Hide, but he'll find you. Scream, but no one will hear you. The hand from the grave. Pray you're out of his reach. Play now at the Galaxy Twin Drive-In. Rated X.
AM, the Easy Mart. The Easy Mart convenience store is on a corner of Broad Street and Meadow Avenue. It's a modest brown brick building with a flat roof and a facade adorned with large glass windows plastered with colourful promotional posters and signs. Out the front is a small five-car parking lot paved with asphalt, an old cigarette machine, and a weather-worn bench nearby. There are several police cars parked around the store, and a crowd has already begun to gather outside.
All right, what do we got?
Brady Hitchcock roughly pushes his way through the throng of onlookers and barks at one of the uniformed officers who is standing nearby.
Good morning, Sergeant.
What's your name?
Officer Daly, sir.
Right, get me up to speed.
Yes, sir. We think this could be the monster again.
Don't tell me what you think, son. Tell me what you know. You got no idea on the victim yet?
Sorry, Sergeant. The victim is Abby Robbins, 14. She lives a few blocks away on Meadow Avenue. The owner of the store says that she came in just before he was closing up around 10 last night to buy her mother cigarettes, and no one's seen her since. Her parents reported her missing just before midnight.
Mm. Any witnesses?
We're canvassing the area as we speak.
Good. Anybody notify the parents?
We're on to it now, sir.
Brady surveys the crime scene. It's ugly. He can feel that something terrible has happened here. The violence hangs heavy in the air, almost as if the heinous act itself has left a stain on the psychosphere of the neighborhood. In the far right corner of the lot, he can see the police crime scene photographer and the forensic pathologist. Nearby, a child's red sneaker sits on its side next to two sets of tire tracks. Brady motions for his partner to follow him, and they cross the lot.
Good morning.
The crime scene photographer Steve Gilmore and the forensic pathologist Dr. Amanda Pike both look up and they say hello as Brady Hitchcock and Lee Lucas join them. A small, severed finger is curled up in a dried puddle of blood on the asphalt in front of them.
So, what are we looking at? Is it the same as the others?
The forensic pathologist looks up at him and nods solemnly. Dr. Pike's skin is grey and her eyes are dark and sunken. Even though she's younger, she looks like a woman twice her age.
I'm afraid so, Brady. Injuries look consistent with the other monster victims. Judging by the lividity, I'd say she was attacked about 8 to 10 hours ago, which fits the timeline.
That's a fucked up calling card.
Brady takes a deep breath and closes his eyes for a moment as his hangover crashes down upon his head in a wave of pain and nausea.
My fucking head is pounding. Anyone got an aspirin?
They all shake their heads. And Brady kneels down gingerly, peering at the little girl's finger. It's shriveled and blue. The flesh at the base of the digit has been stripped back up to the knuckle, and the bone beneath snapped and splintered like a green stick. His heart sinks as he notices the girl's fingernails painted with the same kind of cheap glitter nail polish, same type his daughter uses.
Steve, you get pictures of those tire tracks over there?
Not yet, Brady.
I'll make sure you do. And if they're from our suspect's vehicle, it might be the first break we've had in this case.
Steve, make sure you get the photo straight to me. I'll run it through the national database and see what comes back.
Just then, Abby Robbins' parents arrive at the crime scene. The girl's mother is hysterical, her face a mess of pain and tears and mascara. Her husband tries his best to keep her from collapsing on the street.
Jesus Christ, this is all I fucking need. I thought that dipshit uniform said they were taking care of the parents.
The screaming gets louder as Abby's mother desperately tries to push her way past the police line, all the while frantically screaming her daughter's name.
My fucking hangover's too bad to deal with this shit today. Dr. Pike, let's get that finger packed and back to the lab.
Come see me around noon. I should have something for you by then.
Sergeant Hitchcock, sir.
Brady looks up to see Officer Daly walking over and waving his arms to get his attention.
What now?
Sergeant, we just got word from Captain Dodd over the radio. He needs you back at the station ASAP.
Tell him I'm busy.
He did say that you'd say that. He told me to tell you that the state police are coming in for a briefing at 9, and if you aren't there, that you should find yourself another job.
And it rains, it fucking pours.
I'll go take care of the parents, boss. You go see the captain and I'll meet you at the station later.
Yeah, good idea. Hey, Lucas.
Yes, Sarge?
Make sure you bag that girl's shoe before the parents see it. Let's not add to their fucking misery, okay?
Freddy Hitchcock looks over at the uniformed officer standing before him, struggling to remember his name.
You, whatever your fucking name is.
It's Officer Daly, sir.
Like it matters. Make yourself useful. Go get me a lift to the fucking station. Now!
...9:05 a.m. Port Patay Metro Police Station. The briefing room of the Metro Police Station is lit by a bank of overhead fluorescent tubes that cast a cold, harsh light across the linoleum floors and fake wood-paneled walls. In the center of the room, a long conference table. Seated in the plastic-molded chairs around it are members of the State Police Command, the Mayor, the Chief of Police, as well as other ranking officers in the department. Brady stands at the lectern at the far end, a hastily compiled board of gruesome crime scene and evidence behind him. He slurps down some scalding hot coffee, hoping to get rid of his hangover, and curses to himself for not having another line before starting the briefing.
Okay, Captain Dodd has asked me to give you an update on the case. As you all know, we've had another incident this morning, and time is a factor, so I'll keep this brief. In the last 14 months, two teenage girls have been abducted and murdered in Port Patay. Ellie Rose, 14, and Raynor Langton, 12. Both are suspected to be victims of the same offender.
Where did the name come from, Sergeant? The one in the press?
Well, ma'am, the press named our unsub the Monster after some of the more confronting details of the second murder were leaked. The killer's MO is pretty consistent in both cases. The victims were abducted from public places. In both cases, the killer bit off the victim's right index finger and left it at the site of the abduction like a calling card. Their bodies were discovered no more than 24 hours after they were abducted. In both cases, we received an anonymous phone call from someone we believed to be the killer, telling us they'd committed the murder.
And do we have a recording of these calls?
No, sir. The victims were found in black plastic garbage bags that were dumped in waterways. Both were dismembered with their heads mutilated.
What exactly does that mean?
The killer removed the heads, arms and legs. Both girls had their eyes, ears and tongue removed, and their eyelids, ear canals and mouths sewn shut. At this stage, we haven't recovered the missing organs.
Please tell me these wounds happened post-mortem.
From what we can tell, the victims were alive for at least part of the mutilation. Although there's been no evidence of sexual assault in either case, we have been able to determine that the offender has type O blood, lifted from saliva samples found on both of the victims' severed fingers. We have no fingerprints, no hair or fibre evidence, no witnesses, motives or connections with the victims.
And as of this morning, there's another girl missing. Is that right, Sergeant?
We believe so, yes.
So given our killer's history, come 10 o'clock tonight, we're officially got a serial killer on our hands.
Well, not exactly, sir. There is one more case.
Another? How come I'm only hearing about this now?
Well, sir, it's not official. We got a call a couple of months ago, very similar to the other two calls from the killer, only in this case, there was no severed finger or body recovered. and we're unsure if this was a genuine contact from our unsub or a prank. We're checking it against missing persons cases, but at this point, we don't have much more to go on.
So you're saying there could be more of these?
We don't know. But at this stage, we're not ruling it out.
Police Chief Creeves gets to his feet, straightens his jacket. His eyes blaze with fury.
Thank you, Sergeant. That'll be all. Captain Dodd, we'd like to speak to you in our office, now.
Brady lights a cigarette and watches as the brass file out of the briefing room and into the captain's office. The conversation inside looks heated. He walks over to the briefing room door and listens closely when Lee Lucas strolls into the precinct bullpen eating a donut. With a wide smile plastered across his face, Brady could feel the bile in his stomach rise at the sight of him. He hated the whole easygoing, congenial vibe he had going. In fact, he hated Lee Lucas, period.
How'd it go?
I don't want to talk about it. Did you get anything else from the scene?
Parents say Abby Robbins left her house at 9:45 with strict instructions to go to the Easy Mart, buy a packet of casino cigarettes, and return straight home. The store is 5 minutes' walk from her house. She was seen by a local couple on Meadow Avenue around that time, then again by a tow truck driver in the car park of the Easy Mart as he was driving out, and by the clerk. She purchased the cigarettes and left and was never seen again.
Store have cameras?
No.
Fuck. What about statements? Anything helpful from the parents or any of the locals?
Not much. Uniforms canvass the area. There's two statements look like they might be worth following up.
Just then, the door to Captain Dodd's office swings open, and Police Chief Greaves and Mayor Finn stalk out of the room with dark clouds hanging over them. It didn't look like things had gone well at all. The captain stands at his door and scans the bullpen till he spies Brady, then motions for him to join him.
Go grab the car. Meet you out front in 10. We'll go and check out these leads together.
Brady watches the young detective saunter off across the bullpen, then join Captain Dodd in his office. The room's cramped, filled with piles of files and papers. It stinks of cigarettes, bad breath, and stale coffee.
Get the feeling that didn't go well.
You got that right. State police are officially taking over the investigation Monday morning, but they're working on it as of today. There's a task force arriving in the afternoon to try and assist in finding the Abby Robbins girl before it's too late. I've been instructed to give them our full cooperation. You're gonna need to be here to help with the transition.
But that's my case. I've been working it for more than a year.
It's out of my hands, Brady.
So what does that mean for us?
Police Chief Greaves says it's all hands on deck till we find the girl.
And then what?
Lucas is going to be reassigned.
And me?
The look on the old police captain's face said it all. He reached into his bottom drawer, retrieving a bottle of whiskey and two glasses.
You're going to put me behind a fucking desk.
It's out of my hands, Brady.
Why? Because of the fucking John Bailey case.
Dodd nods solemnly. He fills a glass and hands it to Brady, who swallows it in one.
So that's it, is it? More than 20 fucking years I've given. For what? And they just tossed me aside because I made one mistake.
Jesus Christ, Brady! You beat that guy half to death! Doctors say he's got brain damage!
That fucking piece of shit was drunk. He ran over a 15-year-old girl.
Allegedly. There's no evidence tying John Bailey to the car that night.
He left her dying in the middle of the street. What was I supposed to do?
Find the evidence to get him off the street so he can't do it again.
You know he would have walked.
So you beat him half to death with a goddamn tire iron. Now he's probably never gonna walk again. John Bailey's family is already lawyered up. They're fixing to sue the city and this department.
This is bullshit.
Captain Dodd takes a deep breath and regains his composure, then refills Brady's glass and hands it to him.
Look, you're a good cop, Brady. But the booze just got the better of you.
So I'm fucked.
You'll be on desk duty come Monday morning, pending a formal investigation. If I was you, I'd think about retiring. They ain't gonna let you back out there again, no matter which way the investigation goes.
Brady finishes his drink and nods solemnly.
I appreciate you giving it to me straight, Captain.
Anytime, Brady.
Think I'll head out for a bit. Maybe follow a few more leads and
Do some proper police work while I still got the chance. Who knows? Maybe I'll find the killer, save the girl, and be a hero.
You do that, Brady. Just do me a favor, okay? Go to that session you got this afternoon with that court-appointed psychiatrist. Stuff like that goes a long way with IA.
The drive from the station is long and tense. Brady sits in the car in silence, fuming, ignoring Lee Lucas's attempt at small talk. He replays the events of the meeting with Captain Dodd over and over again in his mind, silently cursing himself for admitting to beating up that perp. Things might have been different if he just kept his mouth shut, but he didn't. His ego wouldn't let him. He wanted everyone to know. Hell, he needed everyone to know he'd kick the shit out of that fucking prick. But why? So he could show those spineless cops like Lee Lucas what real fucking police were all about. The last 2 weeks flashed before his eyes again and again and again. If only he'd kept his fucking mouth shut. None of this would be happening right now. 9:45 a.m., 48 Broad Street. They arrive at the house of the first witness, Howard Granger. He lives across the road from the Easy Mart. His house is a putty shade of grey, with peeling paint, collapsing gutters, and two windows boarded up with plywood. The front yard is filled with rusting junk and long crabgrass. Brady knocks loudly on the front door. After a minute or so, it's answered by a hunched-over man with dirty grey stubble on his cheeks and dressed in an old blue robe. Doesn't take more than a minute talking to him to realize he is a hopeless drunk and completely devoid of his senses. Old Howie, as he refers to himself in the third person, doesn't provide a lot of useful information. But he swears he saw a dark sedan cruising the street near the Easy Mart at the time of the abduction. Brady and Lee thank him for his time and then walk a few blocks to the next witness's house. 10:25 a.m., 22 Boulder Lane. Sharon Brown's house is two blocks south of the Easy Mart. She lives in a well-maintained duplex, decorated in Art Deco style, with a neatly clipped front lawn and immaculately kept shrubbery along the drive. Brady questions Sharon Brown about what she saw last night, and she informs the detective that she thinks her husband Darryl might have something to do with the abduction and that he mysteriously went for a drive last night just before 10 p.m. Brady asks what type of car her husband drives. Sharon tells them that it's a dark sedan. The detectives exchange knowing glances and ask if they can speak to her husband. She tells them he's at work till 5:30, but they're free to search the house in the meantime. The search reveals nothing, and Brady informs Sharon Brown that he'll return this evening and talk to her husband. The two detectives walk back to the car in silence until Lee Lucas clears his throat.
Look, Sarge, I just heard about your reassignment, and I just wanted to say how sorry I am.
Brady bites his lip in anger, barely containing his temper. He needs to do some coke bad. His hangover's miserable. His head pounds and waves of exhaustion crash over him relentlessly. The last thing he needed was sympathy from this prick. He needs to ditch Lee Lucas if he's going to make it through the day.
Oh, save it. I've been in worse fucking binds than this and come out on top. Are there any more witnesses from the door knock we should be speaking to?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Well, forensics said to come in around noon. That shouldn't take two of us. You want to follow up with this lady's husband, Darryl. Maybe pay him a visit at work.
Lee Lucas smiles in relief. He looks thrilled by the idea of ditching Brady Hitchcock for the rest of the day.
Sure. I've got a few other leads I could look into too.
Now let me know what you find. I'll make my own way back to the station.
Brady watches Lee Lucas jump into the car, gun the engine, and peel off down the street. When he's disappeared around the corner, Brady fishes out a vial of cocaine from his coat pocket, taps out a generous bump in the crook of his thumb, and snorts hard. He absentmindedly wipes his nose as he looks around the empty street,
making sure no one was looking, and then heads back over to the crime scene. 11:42 a.m., corner of Broad Street and Meadow Avenue. Brady stands across from the Easy Mart watching the store and drinking from his silver flask. It's bitterly cold out. He closes his eyes and listens to the rustle of the leaves in the wind. He can see Abby Robbins walking to the Easy Mart in her red sneakers, her nails painted in glitter polish. Brady crosses the road and stands in front of the lot, looking intently at the two tire marks, his eyes following where they mounted the car park curb and sped off down Meadow Avenue. He follows them down the quiet suburban street. The trees are bare. Everything looks grey and dying. People look at him suspiciously, probably still on edge from the events the previous evening. He passes an unraked yard with a lone child's toy left in the driveway. Then he sees something just under a shrub near the fence. At first, he thinks it's garbage, but when he stoops down and looks closer, he sees an unopened packet of casino cigarettes. The same brand Abby Robbins was sent to get for her mother. The killer must have tossed them out of the car window after he abducted the girl. Brady retrieves the packet with a pen, then picks it up with an evidence bag, sealing it carefully, hoping there's a print on the cellophane wrapper. He looks at his watch. It's time to go to the lab and see the forensic pathologist.
And now, a message from our sponsors.
It was the psychedelic 1960s, a time for experimentation, a time for drugs and sex and free love. But for these five couples who decided to walk on the wild side, their night of passion will turn into an orgy of violence. The Key Party Massacre. They came to lose their inhibitions. They ended up losing their lives. Coming soon to Baron Sordor's Theater of the Doomed.
...12:27 p.m. Metro Police Department Crime Lab. Brady's nose curls at the harsh, acrid smell of the chemicals as he enters the lab. The room is small, feels cold and sterile. The lab itself is well equipped with sturdy stainless steel workbenches and countertops strategically positioned around the room, each organized meticulously with microscopes, scales, as well as an array of glass beakers and other specialized scientific equipment. Dr. Amanda Pike is working on the far side of the room at the fume hood. She looks over and smiles as Brady walks in.
You're late, Sergeant. I was beginning to think you weren't coming.
No, I'm sorry to keep you waiting, Amanda. I got held up by my prick of a partner.
He's so sweet. Why are you all so mean to him?
I don't know. Someone about him rubs me the wrong way.
Well, how are you? Have you managed to smooth things over with Heidi? Last time we spoke, things weren't going so good.
She's got a lawyer. I'm meeting her at 1 to discuss the divorce.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Brady. I really thought you guys were going to work it out.
Yeah, well. Anyway, this is why I'm late. Look what I found under a shrub about a block from the Easy Mart.
Dr. Amanda Pike's eyes widen with interest as Brady pulls out the evidence bag and shows her the packet of cigarettes he's found.
Do you think this was the packet Abby Robbins was carrying?
You tell me.
Dr. Pike makes her way to one of the workbenches where she removes the cigarettes carefully with gloved hands and examines it with a magnifying glass.
There's traces of blood on the packet here. Let me just dust it quickly to see if there are any prints. Yes, looks like we've got a partial.
You serious?
Most definitely. But whether or not it's our unsubs or the clerks or Abby's, it remains to be seen.
When will you know?
I can get it over to the state police by this afternoon. With any luck, there could be a hit in a day or two.
Can you get it any sooner?
I could try, but I'm not promising anything.
That's good news. What else have you got for me?
Well, that's where the good news ends, I'm afraid. Abby Robbins was definitely abducted by the monster. Have a look at this report I'm preparing for the state police.
Dr. Amanda Pike shows Brady a series of close-up images of Abby Robbins' severed finger.
See, look here. These bite marks are the same as the Rosen Langdon cases. See this denuded bone? He bit her initially with his front incisors. Abby must have pulled away, stripping the finger of its tissue. He's actually bitten her a second time with his molars, causing all this crushing damage and splintering the bone.
Jesus Christ. Can this day get any worse?
It can't be any worse than the day Abby Robbins is having now, can it?
Brady nodded solemnly at this. That was cold, even for her.
I guess we'll find out in the next 12 hours, won't we?
...1:07 p.m. Port Entrance Cafe. Brady closes the door to the car he signed out from the station and walks toward the entrance of the cafe. It's pretty here. Serene. The air smells of brine. The wind is cold and bracing. The little restaurant is located in a park at the entrance to Port Patay. The grey, choppy water stretching off beyond the breakers to the horizon. The park is deserted, except for a group of teenagers hanging out near the water's edge. He recognizes his daughter among them, and he pretends he doesn't see her. Brady does two big bumps of cocaine before he musters up the courage to go inside. His wife Heidi is sitting at the table near the back of the cafe, looking out the window.
Hi. Sorry I'm late.
Did you say hello to Ellie?
No, I didn't know she was here.
She was out there with those girls near the water.
Well, I'll go say hi in a minute. Thanks for meeting me.
My lawyer said I don't have to speak to you anymore.
Yeah, I know. I got his letter.
So what do you want?
I just want to talk. Just you and me. I mean, fuck. How do we get to this? Lawyers, divorce papers. I don't get it. It's you and me, babe. Look, I know I made some mistakes, but it's been almost a year now. Don't you think it's time you let me come back home? You know, give me a second chance.
A second chance? Brady, you used up all your chances a long time ago. I always knew what you were up to. I just lied to myself and pretended I didn't. Now, that was my fault. I don't blame you for that. After Ellie was born, I thought you'd change. I thought you'd settle down and we could become a real family. But you're not capable of thinking about anyone else but yourself. It's always been about you, Brady, what you want. I realised one day that I'd married the wrong man. Or at least, you weren't the man I married anymore. And I can't live with that, and neither can Ellie.
Babe, please,
Dare call me babe. I don't love you anymore, Brady. I don't know if I ever did. Can you understand that? I can't live with you ever again. Ellie doesn't need to see you coming home drunk and on drugs, smashing up the house and beating me up, all because you're so high and so angry that you can't tell your own life from the horror show that's in your head. I want a divorce, Brady. I want this to be over.
You fucking bitch. I came here today ready to give you my heart.
Oh, fuck you, Brady. You're saying whatever you can right now to try and get what you want. You don't care about us. You only want me and Ellie back because you can't have us anymore.
That's not true.
Take a look at yourself, Brady. I mean, really, take a look at who you are. You've never done a thing for anyone but yourself your entire life. It's all about you. No one else. Not even your kid. You need to change, Brady, and I hope you figure that out. I really do. Before it's too late for you. But I am not waiting around for you to do it. I'm seeking full custody of Ellie in the divorce.
The fuck you are. Nobody's taking my baby away from me, you hear me? Nobody.
She doesn't want a thing to do with you, Brady. Besides, With your record, my lawyer says that I'll get whatever I'm asking for.
You'll get nothing. I've got friends on the force.
No, you don't. You're a fucking joke, a dinosaur. No one's going to stick up for you. You should have done what your friends did. You should have retired years ago. You could have made something of yourself. Maybe we'd still be together. Maybe you would have ended up a better person instead of the piece of shit that you are now.
I'd rather fucking kill you both than see you walk away.
Heidi Hitchcock laughs at her husband. She retrieves her bag and removes a small tape recorder from inside and shows it to Brady, then rewinds for a moment and presses play.
I'd rather fucking kill you both than see you walk away.
You fucking set me up, you bitch.
You did this to yourself. You're your own worst enemy, Brady. Sign the divorce papers. Well, this goes to my lawyer. And you'll never see your daughter again.
And now, a message from our sponsors.
So you think you can survive a night of 1,000 maniacs? The new horror game from Splatterhouse Studios. On a cold, dark night, your car breaks down on a deserted road. The same dark night, 1,000 bloodthirsty maniacs escape from a nearby asylum. Armed with only a knife and your wits, it's up to you to fight till dawn or die trying. Night of 1,000 maniacs. To survive the night, you must lose your mind. Available exclusively for Atomic Gaming Systems.
...2:09 p.m. The office of Dawn Clearer, PhD. The psychiatrist's office is tastefully decorated in wood and chrome, with thick white shag carpeting and two opposing brown modular armchairs. Brady sits opposite Dr. Clearer, sullen and brooding. Neither speak, and only the sound of the ticking clock fills the void. After a minute or so, Brady shifts uncomfortably and retrieves his cigarettes from his inside jacket pocket.
There's no smoking in my office, Sergeant Hitchcock.
Brady sighs in frustration before returning them to his pocket.
Well, I must say, I'm surprised to see you here today. I didn't think you'd be returning after our last session.
Yeah, well, it's not like I've got much of a choice.
Tell me, Sergeant, how has work been this past week?
Oh, it's been great. Thanks for asking. I've just been taking off the case I've been working on for over a year. What else? Let's see. Oh, yeah. I've been busted down to desk duty, and to top it all off, I'm facing criminal charges for beating up that prick that ran over that little girl.
And how does that make you feel?
Never felt better.
You know, Brady, that sarcasm is really just a thinly veiled attempt to disguise your own feelings of hurt, fear, and anger. People often use it as a defense mechanism, a means, if you will, of diminishing their own feelings of vulnerability and an unwillingness to acknowledge the deeper underlying feelings.
Jesus Christ. What a bunch of psychobabble bullshit. I'm angry, okay? Is that what you want to hear? I'm fucking pissed that I took a stand against a piece of shit and that I made sure he didn't get away with it and justice was served and no one in the department is backing me up.
You say that you made sure justice was served. Do you think taking the law into your own hands and beating up that man was justice?
I'm a fucking police officer. I am the law.
Surely you don't believe that. I mean, what are the courts for?
Look, you're not a cop. You don't understand. None of you fucking civilians understand.
Help me.
People like you exist because of people like me. But you're too blind to that. All of you. Your heads are so far up your own fucking asses that you can't even see what we do for you, what we protect you from. Do you have any idea what vicious fucking animals people really are? We see society at its worst. The murderers and rapists and fucking junkies and pedophiles. The only thing that stands between you and complete anarchy is us.
The thin blue line between civilization and chaos. If we didn't do what we do, you wouldn't be able to drive to your fucking mansion on the water in your new Mercedes. You'd be fucking raped and robbed and murdered before you even got out of the building. And you've got the fucking nerve to question how I protect you? You've got no fucking idea what justice is, lady. Because you've never seen what real injustice is.
And what is real injustice?
How about a cop being persecuted for simply doing his job? How's that?
Is that what this is?
Try climbing down from your fucking ivory tower sometime and seeing how the other half live. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got some real fucking work to do.
...4:32 p.m. Gemini Cocktail Lounge. Brady sits at the bar, seething. He finishes the whiskey in front of him and orders another. Then he makes his way to the bathroom. After he's relieved himself, he pops a Quaalude, walks over to the basin and splashes cold water on his face. When he looks in the mirror, he hardly recognizes his own reflection. In the yellow light of the bathroom, he looks like a stranger to himself. His face is drawn and waxy and hollow, like he's wearing a mask. And behind his sunken, haunted eyes, he can see the beast that he's become. Whatever stares back at him from the mirror is at best a sad approximation of the person he used to be. How did everything go so wrong? Was there a moment that everything changed? Some tipping point in his life that turned the scales from good into bad? A few years ago, he was on the fast track to being captain. He had a wife and a child that loved him. The scene he made in the cafe comes flooding back to him. What the fuck did he do this afternoon? He moans out loud and splashes his face with water again, hoping to erase the memory that played itself over and over again in his mind.
I'd rather fucking kill you both than see you walk away.
He can hear himself saying those words, the look of hatred in her eyes. She'd never looked at him like that before. If only he could go back and stop himself from saying those horrible fucking things. Brady stumbles out of the bathroom and back into the bar. The room's changed. It's come to life now. There's people everywhere. He must have been in the bathroom longer than he thought. He sits back down on his stool and drinks his whiskey, then slams the glass down on the bar and orders another. The barmaid turns and smiles for a moment, then glares at him in anger.
No way. No fucking way. What the fuck are you doing here?
It takes several moments for Brady to recognize her through the whiskey fog in his eyes. It was the barmaid from this morning. The one he threw the whiskey bottle at in his bedroom.
Oh, hi,
It's Sheila, you piece of shit! You can't come in here, you're banned!
Says who?
Robbie! That guy's back, the one who attacked me this morning.
What the fuck are you talking about? I didn't attack you.
Robbie Crawford, the owner of the Gemini Lounge, comes out of the back office. He looks angry, homicidal even. He's tall and solid, with a boxer's face that looks like it's made of smeared clay. In his hand, he holds a baseball bat.
Get out of here, Brady. You ain't welcome in my bar no more.
Get the fuck out of here. I've been coming to the Gemini for 10 years.
I'm asking you nice. Leave now. I don't want to, but I'll put you on your ass if I have to, Brady.
Are you fucking serious? All because I fucked your barmaid?
That's my sister you're disrespecting. You got to the count of 10 to get out of here before I call your cop friends to come and get you.
The fuck you will.
Brady picks up his glass and hurls it at the bar, shattering several bottles and the mirror behind. The loud smash causes everyone in the bar to abruptly stop talking and turn around.
That's it! Get the fuck out, Brady! I don't ever want to see your face in here again!
And now, a message from our sponsors.
Thank you.
From the streets of New Chechnya, the classic synthwave album by sci-fi favorites Needle in Your Eye, now remastered for the very first time, featuring the classic hits, Cyanide. Technoir. And everyone's favorite, Kobayashi. Ten remastered songs by the originators of dark synth ritual wave music. Available now wherever good music is streaming.
...7:46 PM, Port Patay Metro Police Station. Brady makes his way into the bullpen, his heart still pounding from the coke he did out in the car park. The officer's quiet. Most of the detectives are in the briefing room, and Brady can see Captain Dodd in his office talking on the phone. As soon as Dodd sees Brady walk in, he slams down the phone and storms out of his office toward him.
Brady, where the fuck have you been?
What do you mean? I've been working.
You were supposed to be finished up with the fucking head doctor at 3. It's 8 o'clock at night. I thought you were going to be here to help brief state police for the handover, goddammit. I've been looking for you for hours.
I'm sorry. Look, I was busy following up some leads.
You're the lead detective on this, Brady.
I was the lead detective. I'm on a desk come Monday, remember?
Jesus Christ. A little girl's life's on the line and that's all you've got to say.
Brady remains silent. He drops his eyes and shifts uncomfortably.
You're fucking lucky Detective Lucas was here to cover you. You be sure to thank him when he gets back from his dinner break.
Yeah, I'll get right on that.
Captain Dodd is Brady's smart ass quip and glares at him, noticing his bloodshot eyes, grey skin, and dripping nose with what looks like white powder crusted around it.
What the fuck is that?
He motions to Brady's nose and stares at him in disbelief.
Are you fucking high?
Brady wipes his nose and sniffs loudly.
It's allergies. I swear to God.
Allergies? You're fucking unbelievable, Brady. All right, well, hopefully you're coherent enough to understand what I'm about to tell you. I just got off the phone with the prosecutor. James Bailey just handed himself in at Southport Command 2 hours ago.
Who the fuck is James Bailey?
He's John Bailey's son. The guy you beat within an inch of his life for that hit and run. James Bailey just confessed to stealing his father's car and hitting that poor girl.
You're kidding, right?
Do I look like I'm fucking with you?
I didn't know.
They're gonna throw the fucking book at you, Brady. The mayor wants you gone right now. He flat out said it on the phone 10 minutes ago. If you weren't so close with the chief of police, you would already be suspended from active duty.
Look, Captain, John Bailey did it. I know it. His son's probably covering for him.
Why? Why the fuck would his son do that?
I don't know. So they can sue the city.
Captain Dodge shakes his head sadly and claps him on the shoulder.
I'd contact your union rep if I was you, Brady. See about getting a good lawyer.
Brady feels like he's falling. Fucking criminal charges. He could end up in jail. All because he just tried to... Just then, Tara Barker, the police receptionist, buzzes in on the intercom.
Sergeant Hitchcock? I've got a call for you on line 6.
Not now. I'm busy.
Tara, this is Captain Dodd. I really don't think now's a good time.
I think it's the killer, sir. The monster. He's on the phone. He's asked to speak to Sergeant Hitchcock, sir.
The entire precinct seems to stop and look over in the direction of the phone.
Are you up to this?
Brady nods. Captain Dodd looks over at Captain Gibson and State Police Officer Stone, who is manning the tracing equipment they've set up on the precinct line. They give the thumbs up.
Remember, you have to keep him on the line for as long as you can.
Brady walks over to the phone. He looks at the small, white blinking light and thinks of the madness waiting for him on the other end. He takes a deep breath and puts line 6 on speaker.
Hitchcock. Hello.
I've done it again.
This is Sergeant Brady Hitchcock of the Port Patay Metro Police. Identify yourself. Do you have the girl?
Do you know what happens to naughty children?
Is Abby Robbins all right?
They get punished!
Brady glances over at the officer tracing the call. He makes stretching motions with his hand.
Where is Abby?
They get punished till they can't see. And they can't hear. And they can't lie anymore.
Please, just tell us where she is. We just want to help her.
You can't help her now. No one can. She's in the water now.
Brady's heart sinks as the line goes dead. He looks over at Officer Stone, hoping he managed to trace the location.
Did we get him?
Officer Stone shakes his head.
God damn it! I want every available officer on the streets in 15 minutes. Let's see if we can catch this son of a bitch before he dumps the body.
PM. Port Patay, Orley Park. The call came over the radio at 9:45 that the body of Abby Robbins had been found at Orley Park, washed up on the shore of Port Patay. A couple walking home along the water after going to the movies saw a black plastic bag floating in the water near the seawall. When they got it to shore and opened it up, they called the police. Both of them were now receiving treatment at the hospital because of what they saw. Brady stands alone, watching from afar as a swarm of state police examine the little girl in the black plastic bag. He'd already seen what was left of Abby Robbins. The killer had taken his time with her. It was much worse than the other victims. Brady takes a long drink from his hip flask as Captain Dodd walks over and stands beside him. Brady offers him a belt, which the captain readily accepts.
Anything?
No one saw a thing. He could have dropped that bag in the water anywhere.
Brady shakes his head and sighs deeply.
Look, Brady, about before...
Nah, it's all right, Captain. It's been a long time coming. Think I'll head home. Try and get some sleep.
Yeah, you do that, Brady. There's nothing any of us can do for her now.
PM, Brady Hitchcock's apartment. Brady sits on his couch, TV blaring, a vodka bottle in his hand, a baggie of heroin, a burnt spoon, and a loaded syringe on the coffee table before him. Tears stain his face and he wipes his cheeks before tying off his arm with his belt. Why the fuck was this happening to him? Where did everything go wrong? The day's events play over and over again in his head, his mind reliving every excruciating detail till he feels like he's going to scream. He thinks about his wife and what she's doing to him, and the department and what it's going to do to him. And he weeps, slurring drunkardly, how he doesn't deserve any of this, how unfair it is that these terrible things are happening to him. When a report about Abby Robbins' murder comes on the news, he picks up an ashtray and hurls it at the TV, smashing the screen in a shower of sparks and glass. Where did it all go wrong, he thinks to himself, as he gulps down the last of the vodka. Why is this happening to me?
...7:10 a.m. Brady Hitchcock's apartment. Brady Hitchcock woke as if still in a dream. He opens his bloodshot eyes and peers blearily at the blaring alarm clock on his bedside table.
Jesus fucking Christ. What time is it?
He reaches over and slams his hand down hard on top of the alarm. Brady lies in his bed, letting the sickly waves of his hangover wash over him. He considers closing his eyes and going back to sleep. Then he remembers he has to go to work. Slowly, he sits up and swings his legs over the side of the bed, ignoring the ruin of his head screaming in protest. His bedroom is a disaster. The bedside and the floor are littered with empty beer cans, dirty clothes, and a quarter-filled bottle of whiskey. The remnants of an 8-ball of cocaine are spilled across the top of his dresser. He tries to stand up and feels his stomach lurch, his alcoholic hands already shaking for a drink. Brady reaches down and grabs the bottle of whiskey, twisting off the lid and chugging. It's not till he's almost finished the bottle that he notices the woman in the bed beside him. Brady recognizes her. She's the barmaid from the Gemini.
Good morning.
What are you doing here? What the fuck is going on? What are you doing here?
Brady leaps up from the bed, his eyes wide and panicked, his brain desperately trying to process the insanity of what it's witnessing before him.
No. This can't be happening. It's the same. You're the same.
Sheila ignores his rude tone and stretches seductively across the bed, letting the sheets slip down across her naked body.
It's so early. Why don't you come back to bed?
Jesus Christ! What the fuck is happening?
Oh, my. What confounding conundrum has befallen our brave hero? Has he lost his mind or become trapped in the infernal circle of eternal return? Only time will tell. I trust you have enjoyed your evening, my most valued audience. Sadly, though, we have come to the end of the first part of our story. While I'm sure you are eager to continue, we must, for the moment at least, say goodbye. So please, bolster your spirit and be sure to join us next time for part 2 of the Infernal Circle of Eternal Return at Baron Sordor's Theater of the Doomed.
Blood, Brains, and Aliens presents Baron Sordor's Theater of the Doomed. The Infernal Circle of Eternal Return, Part 1, starring Septimus Caton, Christian Schmidt, Jacinta Stapleton, Kyton Bealby, Felicity Jerd, Lily Bader, Aaron Harvey, and special guest star Jeff Martin as Baron Sordor. Produced by Aaron Harvey, Natalie Lily Harvey and Lily Bader. Recorded at King Sound Studio. Engineer Nick Bird. Casting by Citizen Jane Casting. Music by Il Drone Notturni. Written and directed by Aaron Harvey. For more, go to www.bloodbrainsandaliens.com. Part 2 of the Infernal Circle of Eternal Return is coming soon.